The OR is a world of fascination and unknowns for those of us on the outside. As nurses in acute, critical care, and the emergency department, we care for our patients before they go into surgery and after they come out. But what happens in that space in between? Well, we're about to find out because I have certified registered nurse anesthetists Tanner and Cole as guests today. As founders of Core Anesthesia and with experience both inside the OR and at the bedside in the ICU, they provide unique insider perspective. Tanner and Cole will walk us through the perioperative process step by step, from preoperative preparation to intraoperative anesthesia to post-op recovery. By the end of this episode, you will have a deeper understanding of that surgical experience and be better equipped to support your patient through their surgical journey. Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. My name is Annie. I've been a clinical nurse for 8 years, and I am curious. I use this podcast to address common clinical questions, share unique perspectives across the healthcare team, and cover what's missed in nursing school. Hey listeners, I'm going to be sharing some career updates in a little bit, but as I've been exploring new nursing opportunities, I am grateful as ever to have PCCN certification under my belt. It's been an objective accomplishment that strengthens my resume. Earning my PCCN opened doors to my first progressive care job, helped me climb the clinical ladder, and honestly led to salary increases, not to mention quarterly bonuses. I have Nicole Kupchick to thank. Her online courses and practice questions guided me to pass the PCCN exam. If you don't know Nicole, she has a gift for teaching complex concepts in memorable ways. Nicole wants to support you on your CCRN, PCCN, and CMC certification journeys, and is offering my listeners 20% off all of her products. Just use the code UPMYGAME20 at NicoleKupchickConsulting.com. So if you're looking to boost your skills and career, don't miss this discount. Invest in yourself and your nursing excellence.
My name's Tanner. I'm a CRNA. Currently, I'm in Indiana working and went to school in Illinois. That's where I met Cole. And before that, did travel nursing for several years in the ICU. I'd honestly never heard of a CRNA before when I was an ICU nurse. And so something I thought was interesting, looked into it, and has been just an absolute blast. I love it. And I'm now the co-host of Core Anesthesia, as you mentioned. So Cole and I started this while we were in school. And this was our way to study. We wanted basically to figure out a way that we could make use of time in the car. And so we were starting to record conversations, and all of a sudden it became a podcast, and still riding the coattails. We have no idea where this thing will end up. It's been a wild journey. That's kind of where Core came from, and a little bit about me is from my nursing background.
Do you think it helped you in CRNA school?
Oh my word, yes. That was our studying. Cole put together the outlines. I would do the editing. And by the time I had edited an episode, I'd listened to it like 3 times. And so then I felt like, oh, I know this material. And it honestly cut way down on our study time because we were just working through the material so much. And so people joke, they're like, how did you do, CRNA school so busy? How did you, start a business while you were in school? And for us, it honestly was like, it cut down on our workload a little bit to some extent because it just consolidated kind of how we studied and how we made use of our time. So yeah, it was a great thing.
I love that. That's so smart. Cole, we'd love to hear from you.
Yes. Thank you so much for having us, Annie. Like she said, my name is Cole Dill and I'm a CRNA as well. Tanner and I, as he said, we met in anesthesia school in Central Illinois. started Core Anesthesia, and it's just been a blast and just an absolute blessing to see how much it's grown. As he said, it just started as a way for us to study, and we never dreamt in a million years that it would have grown into what it has become. So it's just been a wild ride, and we're excited to see how it continues to grow. But we're really excited to be on your show today, Annie, so thanks for having us.
I was stoked to find Tanner and Cole, two nurse podcasters who are so well positioned to answer my questions and provide insight into the surgical world. I sought them out after a memorable shift. While I was in the float pool, I was called down to the PACU because they had to keep patients in the PACU for longer than they were expecting. So I went in to kind of take over from the PACU level of care to, you know, post-operative, depending on the patient, like telemetry or step down level of nursing care. And when I was in the PACU, I was kind of looking around like, this is just so different than what I see as a floor nurse. And I was like, I have to do a podcast episode with a CRNA, anesthesiologist, someone who has insight into that area of the hospital, because I just don't. So that brings us to today. The whole goal of this discussion, I hope, is just to illuminate what happens in pre-op surgery itself and post-op for bedside nurses. So kind of speaking to bedside nurses about what goes on in your arena and how that knowledge can help bedside nurses do their job better.
I think that so often in healthcare, we all are on these different units and different areas, as you just said, and it's almost like these bridges to jump from one area to the next, and it kind of discontinues patient care. So doing something like this that allows everything to kind of, I guess, see things as patients move through the different phases and different perspectives is just key. So I think it's a great idea. So I'm really excited to go through it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And so actually, this is a great transition because I wanted to talk about pre-op. And having worked on medical floors before, you know, I'll often have a patient who needs to have surgery for some reason. This is not elective surgery. Like there's something acutely going wrong with the person and they need surgery. But for one reason or another, they won't take them down in the OR. I'm left to explain to them why they're not being taken down. So I was wondering if you could walk us through, like, what is the whole pre-op process? Like, What happens with screening? Like, when can you take patients down? Or what are some reasons why you would not take a patient down for surgery, even if they really do need it? It's not elective.
Yeah, that's a great question. Because I think that it's funny when you're sitting there in pre-op and you're getting report from the floor. You know, both people are talking from their own point of view. So they're like, I can't believe the floor doesn't have X, Y, or Z. And then the people on the floor are like, I've got seven patients. I can't believe you're asking me to do X, Y, Z before they come down. And, you know, you live in your own little world. And so, like Cole said, I think it's a cool place to start. I think just to break it down simply, if you have a patient that is going to be there for an elective surgery, typically for those patients, we'll send them through some sort of pre-anesthesia clinic. And so even before they get to the hospital, it'll be, you know, the week before, or maybe even 2 weeks before, they'll go and they'll see, you know, a primary or somebody who's specifically trained to be asking questions that will coincide with what we need to know for anesthesia. So they'll be asking about home meds. They'll be asking about their exercise tolerance. They'll be asking about any recent illnesses, any changes in medications. Are they on blood thinners? Do they have labs that are routinely drawn for different medications that they're taking? If they do have medications where they draw labs, you know, what are those? How can we get a hold of those? Because a lot of times, as you know, they go to one place for their labs, they go to another place for their primary. And so that meeting is supposed to hopefully consolidate a lot of that information. So on the day of surgery, when we walk in and we're talking to them and they say, yeah, I think I had, you know, something done with my back, it was 20 years ago, that you're not like, okay, well, is this like a cervical spine fusion that we need to know about? Because when we intubate, that could be an issue. Or is this just like a disc removal in their lumbar spine that is really no big deal? It's not going to affect anything that we do today. And so if you have a poor historian, really, you don't want to be finding all that stuff out the day of surgery. Hopefully the pre-anesthesia clinic's where that's all going to happen. Also in that meeting, if they have, you know, different medications that they're taking, some of those we don't want them to be taking right up to surgery. So if you're like, you know, different types of medications like that, that will, you know, either for weight loss or if they're taking it for glucose management, but those we want to be stopped before usually a week, hopefully 2 weeks before surgery.
What are some examples of medications that you don't want a patient to take prior to surgery? Like, you know, blood thinners, you know, obviously comes to mind. Are there like cardiac medications you're mentioning, diabetic medications?
The main ones that we think about, so blood thinners, like you said, depending on which ones they're on, that can either be 72 hours, that can either be 7 days. So it's not like a hard, fast rule. If you're on a blood thinner, you know, that's not universal. There's different things that you would need to pay attention to. And some of them, you're going to want to get labs still the day of surgery. Like you want an INR that morning to make sure that they're appropriate for surgery. So blood thinners would be a big one that would be very important to know when they had stopped it. And that's something that you need to communicate very explicitly. Talking about glucose management, obviously they're going to continue on those short acting things through the day of surgery. There's a little bit changes that we do the night before where you can take like half your long acting dose, or if they're on metformin, we usually have them hold that the day of surgery. If they're on cardiac meds, so if they're on their blood pressure medications, or if they're on like anything with lipids, so like if they're on cholesterol medications or whatever, those will continue throughout the day of surgery. But it's important that we know, because, you know, anesthesia drugs will react differently with different medications that they're taking. So those are things that you want to know about. The other one that I was just thinking about, that if they're on any kind of weight loss medication, the main one I think of is phentermine. That's going to be one that we want to have very strict timetables of when they stop that before they have anesthesia. So again, those are all elective cases, but initially that's going to be like the first step. You have that pre-anesthesia meeting. And then when they come day of surgery, hopefully they're all tuned up, and maybe there's like a last minute lab that we need to get, or there's, you know, some things that we need to look at. You mentioned a different scenario where you're talking about someone that's inpatient. That looks a lot different because you're doing all of that in-house and you're doing that, you know, pretty much all as needed. And that's where it gets kind of fluid when you mention if somebody comes down or needs to come down and they can't. Sometimes that's labs. Sometimes that's just scheduling in the day where all of a sudden there was a more emergent case that came down, or an OR that's not available anymore because something else, you know, filled that spot. NPO status is a huge one that we always, you know, seems to always come up when you're like, okay, it literally happened to me today. The patient in the nursing home was fed their morning pills with applesauce. So we were like, well, it's not going to work for a 9 o'clock case, you know? So they can either delay it, or we ended up canceling it because they couldn't make it work later in the day. So that's another, I think, an easy or kind of low level thing that would delay a surgery. But Cole, you work in cardiac, so there's other, you work in a whole different side of things that would delay or cancel cases. But those are the main ones that I think of in terms of why you wouldn't take a patient if they, you know, needed to go.
Right. And you mentioned, Tanner, there's always seems to be this thing where when we're on a phone conversation getting a report with the floor, they're probably thinking, why are they asking about these things? And we're thinking, why did they not do X, Y, and Z? You mentioned obviously is NPO status. So for a bedside nurse, if you know, it's more so that the night shift, if they know that a patient's inpatient is scheduled for surgery the next morning, obviously we're not going to give them food after midnight. It's typically the golden rule for that. And then, as you mentioned, Annie, blood thinning medications are the biggest one that usually, depending on the case and depending on the surgeon, is what I would say as to when we stop those, because there are some patients that then are going to be at a lot more risk for having a blood clot. And so it's not universal that we're always going to stop the same blood thinning medication for the same period of time. It's always risk versus reward. The thought process should be, if you're a bedside nurse, you know your patient's going to be going to surgery and they're on some sort of blood thinning medication, it's always worth, if you're not already told, reaching out to the surgeon or the attending and saying, hey, what's the plan with this? Is this something that we need to continue all the way through, or should we hold it? I do a lot more vascular cases where we're going to be giving blood thinning medications when they come in the room. We're going to give high dose heparin. In the cardiac cases, I'm giving upwards of 40, 50,000 units of heparin for these cases. And then we reverse it with protamine at the end. So again, those kind of cases are not going to be the same as another general case. Another thing we always watch for is infection. I feel like this is one of the other things that cases always get canceled for or delayed. You have a patient who is inpatient. Maybe they came in from a motor vehicle accident. They have some fracture and they need to go get an ortho procedure done, but they start developing a fever. This is something that we might delay the case until we can get their infection or their fever resolved, because the main reason being that we want to make sure the patient is able to have an active and high functioning immune system to be able to ward off any more infections that would occur after the procedure. But this is, again, all risk versus reward. So a lot of this always falls into this. It's not a universal decision, because if you have a patient that needs that procedure, maybe the infection is the reason we're going in to do the procedure. In that case, we would still do it because we need to treat whatever's causing that infection. For example, if it's a bowel issue or something like that. But that's something I always tell pre-op nurses or the med-surg nurses just to know about, is to be watching for any signs of infection and to pass that along as soon as possible. Again, it might not be 100% we're going to cancel it, but it's a good chance until we get that infection resolved. But this is all for an elective procedure. This is totally different if it's going to be an emergent case. If it's an emergent case, we have to deal with the situation as best as we can. And if they have eaten, or if they had food 2 hours ago, we're still going back there. We're just going to handle our anesthetic differently. And we'll kind of get into that when we talk about the OR side of things. So again, all of these things are not universal, but it's things that if it's elective, we want to make sure they all line up appropriately. If it's emergent, we're going back regardless, and we have to deal with it in the best way possible.
The only other thing I would add on there, Annie, is lab values, such as like electrolytes. I think that's another thing that can be really frustrating. If they had a really low potassium that morning and it wasn't replaced with their replacement protocol or whatever, then we can't take them for surgery unless there's limits onto and what you're willing to take to surgery and to do anesthesia. So I think that's another one that when they're in-house and you see, you know, a morning potassium that's really low, and then now it's time for them to bring them down, we haven't had any replacement, that's another thing that could easily delay some surgeries. But that's one that I've seen more often with inpatient. Obviously outpatient, we're not really rechecking those the day of if it's an elective surgery. But yeah, inpatient, you get those numbers frequently. And so if there's something that's not treated, then we would delay for that.
And one last thing I'd quick add on this topic is anything that is medically treatable and not surgically treatable, if it's an elective procedure, we want it fixed medically. So what I mean by that is, if there's any type of thing that it's not an emergent surgery, but it's something that needs to be corrected from a medical standpoint, from an anesthesia pre-op setting, we want to make sure they are medically cleared for their procedure. So if they have a new onset of AFib, or they have, maybe their EKG shows a recent myocardial infarction or anything like that, anything new, anything medically that's changed that is, and we are not emergently or urgently needing to do surgery, we're going to want them to get medically in their best shape as possible before we take them back to the procedure, because we want to minimize any risk factors that anesthesia is going to put them through. So that's why I basically say anything that's medically treatable. So as Tanner said, fixing electrolytes, fixing whatever the case may be, we get them medically stable first, then we go and do surgery. So that's kind of, if you're going to sum it up in one overarching umbrella, that's the statement basically of why we would cancel or delay a procedure.
Okay. Now I'm getting to the part of the interview that I'm really excited about, because it gets really nerdy. I wanted to ask you to walk through the physiology of general anesthesia. I think that discussion about pre-op kind of sets us up well for this. Look, what are we looking out for in pre-op? What happens to the body under general anesthesia?
We could talk about this for 5 hours. All right, so do it in a couple minutes. Basically, to run you through the process, for those of you that have not been in an OR setting before, here's what the process looks like. Patient is wheeled into the room. We, if they can, we'll move them over to the OR bed. Other times, if it's too painful to do that, maybe we're doing an ortho procedure on their hip, something like that, we'll sometimes put them to sleep on their bed. But typically, we move them over to the OR bed. And the classic saying in the OR room is, we tell the patient it's like a pit crew. There are 3 or 4 people hooking them up to a bunch of monitors all at once. They feel like they're the center of attention because they are the center of attention. We hook up EKG leads, pulse ox, blood pressure, and those are the 3 main things we want to get before we do any type of anesthetic. The other thing I'm doing during that time is I put on an oxygen mask, and this is connected to my anesthesia circuit, kind of looks like a CPAP mask. And I tell everybody it smells like a beach ball. I promise it's just oxygen. It's just because it's a fresh new mask. It has that plastic smell to it. So people always think it's the gas, but it's just oxygen. And our goal here is to fill the lungs up with oxygen and pre-oxygenate the patient. And the goal here is to denitrogenate what's in the lungs. Because there, a lot of people think that we pre-oxygenate to fill up more oxygen, which is true, but you're also clearing out, because room air is only 21% oxygen. And so we want to get rid of all the excess nitrogen that is in their lungs and fill it with oxygen then. And we do that for at least 3 minutes, typically. And so I typically put the oxygen on right away, and I just tell them to take deep, full breaths and basically fill up a reserve then for when we put them to sleep, that we have time that they were going to keep their pulse ox and oxygenation levels at a certain amount while I intubate them. And so while they're breathing that oxygen, we're running their blood pressure, we get everything good. Often they will have been given about 2 milligrams of Versed, I would say typically, unless they have been given that already in pre-op.
And Versed, for our non-critical care audience, is?
It's a benzodiazepine. Yep, it's going to work on the GABA receptor, which a lot of our anesthetics work on. And so I guess in one way you can say it's an anesthetic, but it causes amnesia, so they're not going to remember it. And the wonderful thing is you can give it to them out in pre-op. They will have a full-on conversation if you go back to the OR. They'll completely talk to you and they will act like they're totally fine. And they'll do all the commands that you tell them to do, move over to the bed, hook them up to everything, and they'll have no memory of that whole entire thing since weaning back from pre-op. So I like to give that in pre-op if possible, because a lot of patients, as they enter the OR, those nerves just really start to come out. Looking around, seeing all the equipment, the bright lights. I love being able to give the Versed as we're heading back to the operating room because they have no memory of being in the OR. As I mentioned, you really want to pre-oxygenate these people, denitrogenize the lungs, fill that with as much oxygen as possible, because once we put them to sleep, which we'll talk about here in a minute, we have a certain period of time from when they're asleep and not breathing until we're putting in an airway. And you want to make sure you're giving yourself enough time that you're going to be having enough of that reserve or capacity of oxygen to keep supplying those tissues with oxygen until you can supply them with a new wave of oxygen.
And nitrogen is extremely soluble. And like Cole said, so when we're intubating and we have that time where they're apneic, we're going to take away their respiratory drive. And so if we have a lot of nitrogen left in the lungs, that time is way, way shorter where we have time to safely get an airway and then intubate or, whatever type of airway you're getting. And it's just a safety measure because ideally you're going to intubate in 5 seconds. It's going to be super fast and you don't have to mess with that. Unexpected things happen and you want to do what's safe for the patient. And so that's what, the whole point of this is.
So basically, once we have oxygenated them for an adequate amount of time and we have gotten the blood pressure, we've gotten all our vitals up, we're ready to go. At least this is my process. And again, anesthesia is an art. It's just as much of an art as it is science. So everybody has their own little spin off the way that they do this. I'm going to walk you through my way. So basically, the majority of drugs that we give for an induction, you want to blunt the sympathetic response to an intubation. Because when you put an airway into someone's trachea, one of the ways that you know you're in the trachea and not the esophagus is their heart rate will just jump up. Their sympathetic response will increase. And so without even listening to the lungs, I can usually tell if I have, let's say, a paramedic that wants to intubate and they're in the room and I'm not seeing where they're putting the tube and they put it in, if I see their heart rate jump up, I can almost guarantee you it's going to be in the right spot. But so how do we blunt that? Because there are some patients where you don't want that to increase. If you have a very sick cardiac patient, or maybe you have a patient with a large aneurysm and you don't want it to rupture, you don't want their blood pressure to spike and you don't want their heart rate to jump up. So I usually give fentanyl. I'll give anywhere from 50 to 100 micrograms of fentanyl to the patient about probably 2 minutes before I plan to intubate. And this gives it enough time to circulate into the patient. And I usually do this as they're breathing and pre-oxygenating. And then as I'm about ready to intubate, I'll give lidocaine. I'll give either 50 milligrams up to 100 milligrams of lidocaine. And this is kind of twofold. The main reason is the next drug that we typically give, I would say probably over 90% of the time, the induction drug that we give to make a patient go to sleep is going to be propofol. There are other induction drugs. I know a lot of times in the ICU where I worked at, we used etomidate. So maybe that's something that a lot of ICU nurses are familiar with. Ketamine is also one that we can use, but I would say by and large, propofol is the main one. And propofol burns really bad when you give it as a rapid bolus. when you have somebody sedated in the ICU, you're not going to really see that burning sensation as much. But when you give a big push of up to 200 milligrams of propofol, these patients will tell you it burns. And they'll only feel that for about 5 to 10 seconds and they'll be out. But I always preload that with lidocaine to kind of numb that vein. And that takes away a lot of that burning sensation. And it also kind of blunts that sympathetic response too in the trachea as well when you go to intubate. One of the main reasons is really to blunt that pain in the IV. Once we give that induction drug though, the propofol, like I said, they're out in 5 to 10 seconds if you give the appropriate dose. And typically we give 2 milligrams per kilogram roughly. So if I have a normal 70 kilogram patient, then I'm looking at giving probably 150 milligrams of propofol. And if they're younger, I might give a little bit more. If they're older, I might give a little bit less. And again, that just comes with experience and patient population. Once they're asleep, different anesthesia personnel will do two different forms of things. We typically, if we're going to place a breathing tube, an ET tube through the trachea, we want to relax their skeletal muscles. So we'll give a muscle relaxant or a paralytic. If we are going to want to just place an LMA, laryngeal mask airway, then we won't give that muscle relaxant because we want them to continue to breathe on their own. But if we're doing an ET tube, then we will go ahead and give a muscle relaxant. Typically, this is either going to be succinylcholine or rocuronium. And during that time, the rocuronium takes up to 90 seconds to kick in. So we're just sitting there then. The patient is completely asleep. They're no longer breathing on their own. We are now masking them for that 90 seconds while that rocuronium kicks in. And this is just to relax their airway musculature so that we have an open airway to be able to put that tube through. You don't want that vocal cord spasming and breathing basically during that time. And then as Tanner said, hopefully the intubation is just a couple second process. If we have any concern that it's going to be a difficult airway or difficult finding the trachea and the vocal cords, we'll use what's called like a glide scope, which is a video blade, which is a great tool if you've ever seen that used in the ICU. A lot of people can be able to watch it on the screen. We basically go around the tongue, you find the epiglottis, which is hanging back there, and you put the tip of the blade up in front of that epiglottis and it flips it out of the way and it should expose hopefully the holy grail behind that, which is the vocal cords, and then you slip a tube through that. And then we always just double check, make sure we are breathing, ventilation on both sides, you're getting intidal, that everything looks good. But again, one of the signs that we usually see is that increase in heart rate. But hopefully you don't have too much of an increase if you gave enough of that fentanyl ahead of time. So that's what gets the patient off to sleep. Now we've gotten the breathing tube in, and then the big whammy hits, and that's our anesthesia gas. So Tanner, do you want to go into that a little bit?
So there's different gases you can use. So we can use nitrous. Nitrous has higher problems that are associated with it. Typically, you will not use that with somebody for a whole case because you're going to see a lot more nausea associated with nitrous. Also, it has issues with cardiovascular, so you can see some bradycardia. You can also see, you know, if you're doing a laparoscopic case, we mentioned about solubility of gases a little bit earlier when we were talking about denitrogenating the lungs. But if you have carbon dioxide they're using to they fill up the belly basically so they can work with their instruments inside the abdomen while they're using the laparoscopic tools. And so while they're doing that, if I'm ventilating with nitrous, that can actually diffuse and cause that gas to move into the abdomen and increase pressures, increase that insufflation is what it's called, that increases the gas there in the belly. So that would be not good. It can also have issues with your bowels. So there are a lot of reasons we wouldn't use nitrous. Desflurane is probably the other one that we'll use. If you have like a really long case, you could use that. ISO is one that you would use. I feel like most of the time you see that mostly in cardiac call. I don't know if you use that frequently with your open heart procedures. That's where I use ISO the most. And then sevoflurane is going to be far and away most common gas that we use. So sevoflurane, I'll start with that. Cole mentioned you've got them off to sleep. You've given all of those drugs. Here's the tricky thing. You're trying to think about, okay, so you've given all of those things. You've given fentanyl. You've given propofol. You've given lidocaine. All of those have sedative effects to them. And so now you're trying to turn on your gas and trying to basically reach an equilibrium state where you have enough gas that's in the lungs that's then going to the brain and causing sedation, but it's also going to cause massive vasodilation. And so if you've given those induction drugs and you have this frail 87-year-old lady that you just gave propofol and fentanyl to, and now you need to turn on gas, and we haven't even started the surgery yet, this is where you can see really, really bad low blood pressure. I mean, we're just dumping in all of these agents that are basically just decreasing blood pressure. And so that's kind of a critical point in the case where they call it the valley of the prep, where they're prepping the patient and they're prepping, you know, it takes 3 minutes, 5 minutes, whatever. And everybody's positioning the patient. Meanwhile, you're trying to keep them asleep. And then your blood pressure is like this massive valley on your chart because they're, you know, bottoming out. And that's what you want to avoid as we are thinking about, okay, how long is my propofol acting? How long is my fentanyl acting? How long is my lidocaine acting? So that's all kind of coming down while you're turning on your gas. And then when they start the case, it's obviously going to be painful. The patient's not going to know because their brain's asleep. We've done that with the gas that we're using, but their body still knows what's happening or can't know what's happening. And so they can see a spike in blood pressure, spike in heart rate. You can see a spike in respiratory rate if you don't have them paralyzed. And so those are all things that you're looking at while you're, you know, keeping them asleep.
Can I ask a pretty simple question?
Sure.
I kind of thought during surgery that you were getting this constant IV drip of some kind of anesthetic or, you know, something like that to keep you asleep. But you're saying it's gas that keeps you asleep.
Yeah. And you can. It's not a dumb question because you can have that. Yeah. We mentioned earlier somebody that has like nausea associated with nitrous. So this is something that's really, really common with anesthesia. And a lot of PACU nurses will attest to this. They come out of anesthesia and they're horribly nauseous. And one of the main offenders of that is the anesthetic gas. I would say the biggest offender is the anesthetic gas. One of the ways that you can avoid that is you can just do an IV drip the whole time. So you could use propofol the entire time and just put them on a rate. In the ICU, I can't even remember. Cole, do you remember what rates you would put somebody on for sedation in the ICU?
I don't remember ever going over 75. That was just my ICU though.
And in the OR, you'd be at 200 easily. For general anesthesia, it's like a whole nother level of propofol administration when you're doing.
But then that comes with the risks of associated with propofol, like bottoming out the blood pressure, and
which is why it's so much of an art. Because as Tanner talked about, there's that lull in between you put the patient to sleep, and sometimes it could take up to a half hour if it's a very like if it's let's say we're doing a spine case, and now we have to flip the patient over prone. Make sure they're padded on every surface underneath. Everything's appropriate there. They have to go and they have to figure out which level of the spine they're going to work at. They mark it all. They prep. They get all their drapes up. They're ready to start. We do a timeout. I mean, it could be a half hour. And you have this period now where you have this sick patient that has no surgical stimulation, but you have this medicine on board. And so as Tanner mentioned, it is this art of you have just enough to keep them asleep, but not enough to bottom them out. And then you slowly titrate that up so that when they make that initial incision, you hopefully got them deep enough where they're starting to bottom out right as that incision starts, and then that increases it and it levels out that equilibrium. So that's why it's just as much of an art, and that's why I love it, because every case is different, but it's also the same in a way. But that's also when you have a very sick patient and you're putting them to sleep, that's the biggest risk of them coding is during that time, especially in the cardiac world. When I do a lot of open heart and things like that, that's the time that we're the most nervous about them coding, is we're going to bottom them out and we're going to take away that cardiac reserve on induction and when we put them to sleep. And so there's different ways you can do it. But one of the best anesthesia jokes that I had heard actually while we're talking about with your question. So what Tanner mentioned, we run an IV drip the entire time. We call that a TEVA, a total intravenous anesthetic, rather than a volatile or gas anesthetic. So a TEVA, if we ever say we're going to do a TEVA, that means we're going to put the patient to sleep and we're not going to run gas. We're just going to run the IV anesthetic. And so there was once an anesthesia person I knew that bought a Tesla, and his license plate, he called the Tesla TEVA because it doesn't run on gas. It's total IV anesthetic. So, but there's your anesthesia lame nerdy joke for the day.
I like that. That'll help us remember
it.
Yeah,
exactly.
How often are you doing a TEVA?
I love TEVAs. I want a TEVA. When I have surgery, I want a TEVA.
Because of the postoperative nausea?
Yeah, I get sick real easily. And there's different risk factors for it. If you get motion sick, that puts you at risk. If you're a female, it puts you at risk. If you're a non-smoker, that puts you at risk. If you're young, that puts you at risk. There's the stratification that we go through to see if someone's more likely to be nauseous. But I get nauseous. I had my ACL repaired and I was really, really nauseous afterwards. And so if anybody tells me that they have a propensity to be sick, I run a TEVA and they wake up so nicely. Not saying that most people don't wake up nicely from anesthesia, but in terms of feeling sick and feeling gross from the anesthetic gas, Ativa is very, very nice.
But then you would have to have the cardiovascular health, I'm guessing, to tolerate Ativa. Like, why don't we just do it on everyone?
It's a little more expensive, and I wouldn't say a little more. It's more expensive. And the other thing is the gas is very, very nice because it's very fine-tuned. It's very, very specific and very, very nice for managing the patient. Also, a lot of times you don't have the IV access or you don't have, you know, access to the patient, but we have access to the airway. We're the airway experts. And so we're managing, you know, all of the sedation and everything through the airway. And so that's, we're at the head of the bed. We're right there. That's everything that we can manage. And so it's not that common. I would say I use Tivas more than the average person. And I've probably done 3 this month. So not very common. The other thing that I would tell you we use Tivas for is MH. And so one of the hallmark triggering factors is the anesthetic gas. And so for those patients, we literally take the gas like out of the room so you don't accidentally turn it on. So for those patients, you would run Ativa as well.
For listeners who aren't familiar, MH is malignant hyperthermia. I think it's a highly genetic condition that causes the patient to spike extremely high fevers very quickly postoperatively, often in reaction to gas. There are other medications that can do
succinylcholine. Yeah. Would be another drug that stimulates it. Yeah. And it's all because their ryanodine receptor in the muscle cells basically stay open, and you constantly have that muscle contracting, and you constantly are able to have carbon dioxide come out, potassium leaks out. They rapidly increase your carbon dioxide. Actually, the hyperthermia is one of the last things that we see as a symptom. Yeah, it's something that you don't want to mess with. It could be fatal. So as Tanner said, we actually will flush the anesthesia machine for 30 minutes with just pure oxygen to try to get any residual gas out of there and run Ativa for those. But to fall back on one quick thing he said with the nausea, with the risk factors, this is one of the only things I am aware of where a non-smoking patient is more at risk for something than a smoking patient. So when Tanner went through that, if you are a non-smoker, you're more at risk for being nauseous after surgery when you wake up, which I thought was always interesting.
We're not telling you to smoke before surgery.
Yeah.
No, not at all.
Yeah, let's be clear here.
But for sure, yeah.
Yeah, so I think this you know, segues beautifully into the post-operative discussion here. As someone who does not work in PACU, but I see patients just after PACU, you know, the common post-surgical nursing milestones we're looking at is pain management, nausea, getting them to go to the bathroom, mobilize. I wanted to ask you about what exactly is the pathophys of post-operative nausea and vomiting? And also, why do patients have such a difficult time voiding after surgery? I've always wondered this.
For sure. I'll start with the post-operative nausea and vomiting, because this is something that I really take seriously, because I had felt it and it's miserable. You know, you just feel awful. You already have a surgery on, you know, whatever. You're focused on recovering from that. And it is such a problem when somebody feels, you know, horrible after the surgery. And the problem is, like, you can talk about pain. We could spend a whole episode just talking about pain, but there's so many different ways that you can attack pain. I mean, you have, from the moment something happens, you have these mediators that are causing the pathway to start. And so you can stop the pain pathway there by giving anti-inflammatories and things like that. So that's one place you can attack it. Or you can attack it by giving opioids. And so that's going to attack it in different areas where you have your opioid receptors. Or you can, you know, Precedex even works on pain receptors with the alpha 2. And so there's totally different ways that you can attack the same pathway. And the same thing with nausea and vomiting. You have different reasons that you're going to have that start. I mentioned risk factors. So non-smoker is going to be a risk factor. Female gender. If you have motion sickness, that's a really big one. I'll get into this in a second, but typically we give somebody like a scopolamine patch if they have a history of motion sickness. Younger patients will typically have that. And then you can also see just depending on the type of procedure it is. So if you have like an abdominal case, or if you're working on the ear or the eye, you can see, you know, increased nausea compared to maybe like a knee or something like that. Typically, when we think of where this is happening, it's happening from the CTZ, which is the chemoreceptor trigger zone, which is basically like a weak spot in your blood-brain barrier. We think that's where the anesthetic gases are causing the most effect with the nausea, is in that CTZ area. And so that's one of the areas we can try to attack. The vestibular apparatus is in your ear, and that's one that will, again, with scopolamine, or if you have someone that has motion sickness, typically that's where we're thinking that's coming from. The GI tract is where you have your 5-HT3 receptors and also your NK1 receptors. So those are all going to be in the GI tract. And that's going to be, I should say, not only in the GI tract, that's also in the CTZ, but those are going to be specific receptors that we're trying to attack with medication. So we can give Zofran. Sometimes in PACU, if they're having issues, we can give Benadryl. Antihistamine will work on the H1 receptor. That will also help. Phenergan's one that you see kind of as like a next level medication that you can give. You can see Amend. Typically, you'll give that preoperatively. You can also see like Reglan. Reglan's not going to really affect your postoperative nausea and vomiting, but it's going to help your stomach clear anything that's in there. It's going to help with gastric motility. And so if they do get nauseous, it's going to hopefully decrease, you know, any risk of vomiting or aspiration. And so those are all like the areas that we're trying to attack. What's causing the issue is going to be your, like I said, you have those risk factors. Opioids also are a high offender. And then our anesthetic gases are going to be the primary thing that you'll see. I had a patient today, no history of nausea. I thought that she looked really good the whole case, woke up just fine. And then I went and checked on her 15 minutes later in PACU and was just feeling really, really sick and really, really nauseous. The case didn't make me think it was anything that would make her high risk, but she just, this is her first anesthetic and she felt really crummy. So that's something that moving forward, next time she has surgery, she can say, hey, last time I felt really nauseous. So they can do all the things. They can give the scope patch. They can maybe do a Teva. They can give, you know, all the different antiemetics. Because typically for somebody that doesn't have a history, you might use one or two of these. Maybe use Decadron and Zofran. Maybe you just use Zofran. But if I have somebody that comes to me and they say, hey, I was really sick last time, no gas, scope patch, Zofran, Decadron, Reglan, like you're getting all the things. We're going to try to attack it as many ways as possible. And so that's really, I think, the quick and dirty of why you're seeing the more nauseousness happen after surgery.
I'm unfamiliar with Decadron as an antiemetic. Like, how does that work?
They don't really know.
Fair enough. It's like half the things we do in medicine.
It's shown to be effective. But yeah, the actual mechanism, it's not like it specifically is for a specific, like the 5-HT3 or the NK1 or the H1 receptor. It's not a specific receptor that we know of that it works on.
And that's one of the reasons I feel like we give it, because one, we know it helps with nausea and vomiting afterwards, but two, it's nice because of the fact that it is a steroid, so it's going to help limit the amount of inflammation from the airway that we just put in, maybe some of the inflammation from the surgery. And so like if there was a very difficult intubation and I know they're probably going to have a very sore throat, you better believe I'm going to give a full dose of that Decadron just to help minimize any of that inflammation that they may have in the back of their throat when they wake up. So it's kind of nice to give it for two different reasons in that standpoint.
Will you give it in the OR during the procedure?
Yeah, I'll give Decadron. That's one of the first things I give after they're asleep. So they probably haven't even started the procedure yet, and I've given Decadron just to give it time to kind of stop any inflammation before it starts. So your other question, unless you have any more on the nausea and vomiting, I was going to get into the bladder side of things.
Yeah, no, let's do the bladder side of things. I'm so interested.
So there's a couple different mechanisms at play here. So as Tanner just talked about, there's several mechanisms with nausea and vomiting, and it's nice to know the different mechanisms because we can treat it from different standpoints. Same thing is true here. So there's really two different parts to voiding. There's first the filling of a bladder. So this is going to be a sympathetic nervous system innervation. So this is anywhere from the thoracic 10 to the lumbar 2 spine where the nerves come off of there are going to cause a sympathetic response at the bladder. So your detrusor muscle, if we inhibit that It's going to allow the bladder to relax more, and it's also going to activate the sympathetic side of things, will activate the base of the bladder, basically like the neck or the urethra part of it, which is going to basically keep it tightened and allow the bladder to fill up. Then you have the second side of things. You have a parasympathetic innervation coming off the pelvic nerves, and this is going to be your S2 to S4, your sacral nerves that are going to come off, and they will then activate that detrusor muscle, which causes the bladder to basically squeeze and contract, and then they'll also relax the bottom of the urethral part of the smooth muscle and allow you to void. So there's two different sections here, just filling and then voiding. So the different stuff that we do from anesthesia side of things is going to affect both of those side of things. So from a general anesthetic, let's talk about that first, because we can do general, we can do a spinal, regional anesthesia, all of those, which can cause issues here. So a general anesthetic, it in itself acts as a smooth muscle relaxant. So it's not like a full-on paralytic, but that gas as itself will cause that smooth muscle to relax, and it leads to a decreased ability of the bladder to contract, if that makes any sense. So you have some lingering effects there as they're waking up in terms of the detrusor muscle kind of restarting itself and being able to fully squeeze and empty. So they may be able to void a little bit, but they're going to have trouble completely squeezing and voiding their bladder completely. Same thing then with the spinal and epidural anesthetics. So if we are basically blocking the nerves in that area of the spine, you can see how you're not going to be able to innervate that muscle to allow the detrusor muscle to squeeze and the push out that urine. So that's one of the ways. Secondly, you have the medications that we're going to give. So opioids is one of the big factors here. So as Tanner talked about, opioids are going to affect nausea and vomiting. At the same time, opioids will also decrease the gastrointestinal motility. And then also from a voiding standpoint, it's going to decrease the sensation of the distension of the bladder. So patients aren't going to realize they have as much distension and ability to void, and it inhibits the parasympathetic side of things. So that's the part I talked about that causes actually to squeeze and relax the urethral part of their bladder and allow them to actually void. Basically, the theme is if you can limit opioids afterwards, you're going to do yourself a lot of favors. And that's why there's a big push in anesthesia for peripheral nerve blocks. Because let's say we're doing a shoulder case. We can do what's called an interscalene nerve block and block that whole sensation. We can give medications that'll last even for several days. And you can limit the amount of opioids you need to give for the first couple of days. And patients are able to have better motility right off the bat. The gastrointestinal mobility is better. They're able to void better. It's just all around better to limit opioids afterwards.
We should do a whole nother episode on just like peripheral nerve blocks and like opioid-free anesthesia, opioid-sparing anesthesia, all the different things that you can do. It's fascinating. It's so fun. And this is different, but like a spinal anesthetic, you can do a total knee on somebody, give them a spinal, and you know they have their knee completely replaced, and they can be sitting there talking to you the whole time and have no sensation, no pain. We don't do that because it's like it's horribly gruesome while they're, you know, hacking a knee out and they're like hammering the knee like prosthesis in, and nobody
wants- you could probably like hear the chiseling. Yeah.
Nobody wants to hear that.
Their mouth is open and they're just talking to us, you know?
So fun. Fascinating.
During my time in the flow pool, I saw quite a few surgical patients with regional nerve blocks, like, for example, patients who had had shoulder surgery. And I can attest to how cool they are. And I can totally understand Tanner and Cole's enthusiasm for this kind of subsection of anesthesiology. But taking a step back here, listening to Tanner and Cole paint a picture of the whole perioperative setting has been so helpful. And while I'm not planning to pursue OR or PACU nursing, I do think there is value in knowing what's going on in these areas of the hospital.
I think that even from a working standpoint, a lot of times we get so focused on our own goals that then somebody else has to pick up the slack. Like for anesthesia, for instance, my thinking a lot of times is I need to get them safely through this surgery. Like start to finish, that's my job, is to get them through the surgery. And if you take that too far, you don't think about, okay, well, what do they look like 7 hours after this when they're back on the floor? So did I just give this dialysis patient 3 liters of fluid during the case that now you guys are like chasing your tails to get back normalized? And so I think a lot of times you can think of, if you're on the floor, you know, you're trying to get through your keep taking care of the patient and take care of all the needs that they have on the floor. And then pre-op is thinking about, okay, well, I need to get them through pre-op to surgery. PACU is how can I get them out of PACU back to the floor? And I think that as we start to think about these other different services, you know, what are our needs and what are our primary things that we're focusing on? I think that ultimately just provides better patient care and gives the patient a better experience. So it's not this, you know, like you mentioned at the beginning, siloed effect of people just doing what they need to do, but we can work, you know, in concert together, and hopefully it's a more seamless transition. I think moving from PACU, they're so groggy, they're tired. A lot of times they're, you know, half our patients anymore have sleep apnea. And so we're having issues with, you know, them still being sleepy and now they're desatting, and the PACU nurse just wants them to get to the floor, but they can't give them more pain medicine because they're going to be too sleepy. And I think that as we, you know, broaden our horizons of like, okay, how can we really focus on the patient? How can we take care of them? I think that it's helpful to have this conversation to see other people's perspective, maybe, you know, hopefully that all aligns at some point when we're taking care of the patient.
Yeah, absolutely. If listeners want to hear more from you, where can they find out more about all things CRNA?
For sure. So first and foremost, you can find us on any podcast platform. It's Core Anesthesia. And then if you wanted to download our app, we have an app as well called Core Anesthesia. And all of the content that we have on the podcast are one package placed on the app. Over three quarters or three quarters of the content's free. So for anybody that's just interested in learning about the anesthetic side of things, we do more than just anesthesia. We do episodes on cardiac pharmacology. So all the different inotropes and beta blockers, anything that you'd probably give in the ICU, all the different forms of induction agents. So ketamine, propofol, Versed, all those type of things. We kind of go through things that we found have been very impactful for nurses that are considering going to anesthesia school, or just ICU nurses wanting to know more physiology. So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to check us out either on our app, Core Anesthesia, or just look us up on it, wherever you podcast. But again, if you're looking at going to anesthesia and potentially interviewing, applying for school, starting a program, Tanner and I have pretty much created a full curriculum of audio-based content that walks through the entire curriculum of anesthesia school, at least from our program standpoint, which we've found has been pretty much the same through most programs around the country. So you can find us in either of those two places.
All right, Cole, Tanner, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having us. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks, Annie. Appreciate it.
Thank you for tuning in today. If you have found value in this podcast, I would be so grateful if you could pay it forward and share it with a fellow nurse or leave a review. Leaving a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify is a really big help. It only takes a minute. By spreading the word, you enable the show to reach more nurses so we can keep learning together. It's been an honor to have you join me on this journey today. Until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.